Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I'm on SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Justin Meinhardt joins me to talk guest every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone to dial 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talks website at www.talkshow.com and search for call ID 17702. But if you want the best online experience, yes, you want to go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall, and you will find us there, and you will join the chat room and join the other chatters and chatting away and watch my beautiful face at any time. And of course, we do have a YouTube channel for where I post up things after the live podcast is over. Of course, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, you can follow me on Twitter or X, whatever it is called this week. You can follow the podcasting account at sfuoncall, or you can follow my personal account at Paul Franz, PAUFRANZ. There is no T in that. And of course, also my business account, which is Franz Games. That's FRANZ. GAMES, again, there's no T in that. And of course, this lovely TalkCast gets into the podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from AV this week. Again, Steve Cole was working on the art for the Orion Massive Starship book, and Steve Petrick was working on updating Module K, which I know actually there was somebody on Facebook actually asking about that. I'm pretty sure Gene answered that. And of course, finishing up on some things on the Orion Master Starship book. I'm not sure what that is because I thought it was done, but hey, obviously they found some more things that Steve, i.e. Mr. Petrick, needed to work on. And this week on Found on the Online Store, we had the FedCom Omega Playtext Rulebook. I'm sure a lot of people went with no surprise there. It's, again, only $6.95. On the far side of the ISC is the impenetrable galactic void, a dead zone in which no ship can survive. Beyond that void lies the Omega Sector, a wild and warlike area where 24 empires battle for survival with new ships and new weapons. These empires and ships have previously been presented in SFB in the series of 5 modules, and now this playtest package makes 5 of those empires available for testing under the Federation Commander game system. Including here are the rules for 12 new weapons, background for 5 of the empires, big surprise, and 2 typical ships each for the Mizoran Alliance, Trobriand Empire, the Prober Revolution, and one ship each for the Iridani, Questers, and the Federal Republic of Aura, the FRA. Each ship is presented in squadron scale and in both full color and low toner versions. In other words, we can actually save some ink. Moving onward and forward to the online tournament. Yes, as I announced last week, the Sapphire Star 17 tournament signups are open. I did add on Monday instead of Saturday, but I got it done. So you can sign up. Currently, there's 5 signups so far. And hopefully we'll see more there. I will, given that we've got so low on signups, I will probably send out an email reminding people that there is a new Sapphire Star tournament. And if things don't go well, you're going to see me in that Sapphire Star tournament myself. I always like to keep it open to my players first, not my customers. I figure that's only right. But, you know, also I need some practice too. Moving on forward. When it comes to library, there's still a couple updates I need to post from Frank, and I'm sorry it's taking me so long. Last week, I was out of town. And also the FedCom library, I've not gotten around to updating the 2 ships, and also talked to Steve Cole about the gunboats. And with that is news for this week. Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. And it's me. And tonight we have Doug, Say hi, Doug.
Hi, Doug.
And Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
That's good that people know your name. You know each other's names. That's good. Gary knows Gary, and Doug knows Doug. He's Doug, so. That's a good start. So. Gary's back, and what we're going to do is we're going to continue on the conversation that we started last week, and we're unable to finish, and that has to do with the Nebulae. Just a reminder, the Nebulae lived and operated in active nebulas in the M81 galaxy. And we're one of the three main enemies of the Tholians in the Martial War, and the only enemies of the Tholians to survive that war unconquered. The Nebulae were defeated, but many hard-to-find colonies remained. With the establishment of the Tholian world, the Nebulae were the only significant exception to total Tholian control, and only because the Tholians avoided entering the deadly nebula, where the Nebulae bases were hard to find, and Nebulae ships had a serious advantage in combat. Each Nebulae enclave was separate. They were too far apart to combine into a larger power block, and trade between them was difficult. Each Nebulae colony needed resources from the outside its nebula and resorted to piracy, illegal mining, and clandestine trade with slave species that were supposedly under the Tholian will. Nebulae became the basis for the underground economy that formed the framework that made piracy by non-Nebulae species possible. Only because the Nebulae could never be conquered could piracy never be eliminated. From time to time, the Tholians or enforcer species would fight their way into a particular nebula to clean out the Nebulae colony, but there were simply too many nebula, and only some of them had Nebulae colonies inside them. Most of the time, Nebulae colonies were carefully managed their activities and those of the network of pirates they supported to avoid pushing the Tholians to the point where they had to attack their colony. So, that's a quick description from Captain's Log number 41. So, I figured that's a good way to start it. Also, one minor also thing, the Nebulae developed designs that became known as the Old Galaxy Pirate Raider and Destroyer from the early warship designs that fought during the Martial War. The large wing was added when it was adopted to piracy. The Nebulae continued to operate the wingless, pure warship designs only inside the nebula and only for defense. The Raider and Destroyer designs were used outside the nebula for raiding and some trading, and more capable trader form the bulk of the pirate forces. So, and for those of you watching, I'm just going to bring up the old Galaxy Pirate Raider. Note, this is not an Orion ship.
And you
just notice on this, it mentions, okay, if it's captured a small freighter, it's turn mode D, large freighter, turn mode E. And what movement cost of one for a small freighter and movement cost of 1 1/6. Man, what a movement cost. Dang. That's 7/6 movement cost. So it's a very awkward movement cost. It's bad enough that it could be a third. But a sixth? Oh, give me nice decimal points. You know, that's so much easier to deal with. Oh, yeah.
Divide it by pi while you're at it. Jeez.
Definitely.
Make sure you have the right number of decimal points in pi.
Agree. Okay, let me get back to the other one, which is the nebula, which is obviously, since it seems like currently, at least Steve Cole hasn't explicitly saying, has not explicitly said what the Nebulon ships with what additional weapon systems they have, what capabilities they have that are specifically designed to work in the nebula and help them to defend the colonies and defend themselves within the nebula, so that they don't get completely wiped out. You know, I understand that when it comes to, you know, the Tholians or any of the enforcer races, just going to the nebula, a nebula itself, has all kinds of difficulties. And we'll just go through some of those really, really quick. Shields only function at minimum level. That means 5 boxes on each shield. Electronic warfare, automatically 9 points of ECM is provided, which is the natural source. So in theory, in addition to the 9 points, I'm pretty sure you can add an additional 6 if you want to, of power to ECM. So that's a lot of ECM. I think that's like a plus or minus 3. It's a 3 shift, I'm pretty sure. I'd have to double check on that, but that feels like that'd be right. Because what their logs? Something like the collateral damage?
I do not recall.
Yeah. Additionally...
So just before we go any further, just a point, just a quick reminder for anyone listening or watching is the SSC, so in the Captain's Log 41 article, it mentions that the Nebulon exports variants of the Raider and Destroyer, or they remove key Nebulon technology from these export models. So it's basically like the reverse situation with the Orion pirates and the Wayne Orions. So the SSD that is being shown or discussed about now is the export model. So it's no better inside of Nebula than any standard ship. But what I'm hoping that we could go over today, because some of this is posted in the on the BBS in the Nebulon discussion thread as well, is to try to figure out A, what these ships can or cannot do without any extra technology, and then also for B, to figure out what would be reasonable in game terms to give them that would be an advantage, but not so bad an advantage that no one would want to play it.
Right. Okay. By the way, Gary, I don't think there are any ships for the old galaxy pirates in Caps Log number 41. Because I don't see any. I see the Juggernaut.
Log 40.
Oh, it's 40. Okay.
Yeah, 40 has the Raider, the same Raider that you have the PDF for on the right there. Remember, it's in the theme for playtest on the ADB website.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah, because this was.
Do you have it already, or?
I did not get Cab's Log number 40. No. I just had the 41, which obviously has history. What's that? I'm sorry.
Okay, so if you go to the ADB website and then click on the 8Z index.
Okay, I got.
And then scroll down to P, and you'll see a link that says things to keep playtesting, things to playtest.
Right. I've got that one, which is R1591.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one.
Yeah.
So the only other one is because that same SSC is in Captain's Log 40, but there's also a destroyer model which is a bit smaller, and the destroyer one can only carry a small freighter; it can't carry a large freighter. But we don't need to worry about that SSC right now because even just the Raider Cruiser one is enough for the purposes of our discussion, I guess.
Right. Understood.
Although, as an aside, anyone who's interested in Federation Commander, Captain's Log 40 also includes ship cards for those two ships, too. So if you want to see how they are in FFB relative to FFB, you can try them out there.
Okay. I'll have to keep that in mind and probably pick up Captain's Log number 40 this week. Did not think we were discussing so soon. But anyway. There it is. We're coming to Nebula.
Now, also, the handy thing is that once we're finished reviewing the Nebula rules on the PDF there, the Master Rulebook, we can always go back up to some of the earlier rules. Like, for example, you can go up to, I think it's like D6 point something, which is not about a Klingon cruiser, but it's actually about use of electronic warfare. So you should be able to use it, because it'll actually tell you, like, what the different die roll ships are for direct fire weapons based. And also what the TAC intel adjustments are. Because the way the TAC intel works is that each die roll ship equals a step down in tactical intelligence that you have. So let's say, for example, if there's a type of information you get about the enemy ship at 100 hexes ordinarily, a +3 ship would bring you down to, I think, 30 hexes or something like that. So you've got much less leeway in terms of preparing for, like, an encounter, if you have one in there.
Understood. Yeah, that's one thing that is rarely used by players, which is the TAC intel rules. Now, overall, I think they're pretty cool. But usually the problem is with the TAC intel rules is just the amount of record keeping that's required. I'm not sure what that is. To measure, okay, how much you actually know about this ship and so forth.
Well, I mean, in theory, you wouldn't need to worry about the TAC intel rules too much here either, but it's just that would be useful in terms of, like, if you're crafting this empire in a way that works in universe, then the TAC intel rules will basically inform how you'd be able to set things up relative to an open space empire.
Right, but at the same time, from the sounds of the Nebulon didn't have a great variety of ships. So when it comes to the Nebulon himself, there is no advantage for being in the Nebula when it comes to TAC intel for the most part, because one of the things that TAC intel gives you when you're playing in, you know, the real SFB, i.e. not the tournament, the normal SFB, let's put it that way, that you don't know what ship it is. Because there's, you know, a number of ships that have the same hull class, but you don't know what ship that is, so you don't know what the capability. That's what TAC intel is about. But the thing of Nebulon is that the Nebulon themselves don't have many ships, so... You know. Yes, Doug.
Yeah, that's what I just said it was a fog of war thing. I was pointing out the obvious.
Ah, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Basically, that's a short version of what I was saying.
Yeah, because in the TAC intel rules, there are tactical implications. So, for example, like you gather a certain amount of intelligence at levels A, B, C, D, or whatever. But there's also the strategic level TAC intel, so S1 through S5. And those, some of them they don't give specific ranges for. But the assumption is that they're, in open space at least, they're far enough away that you have time to figure out that someone's coming or whatever. But unless you've got something like a cloaking device or a stealth field or whatever, just trying to mask your movement. But so at that level at least, that would also be the case, because it also might impact, let's say, for example, if the Tholians or Sultorians are trying to go into the Nebula, well, there'd be questions as to how far can they actually scan to find anyone inside? And also, how far apart from each other can they be so they can actually communicate with each other? Because, like, if the invading fleet has to, each of the individual ships can only be a certain distance away from each other so that they can maintain contact, that could make, you know, exploring, like, a large-scale nebula a very daunting task. Because, I mean, it could take years. I mean, they have the time because they have a strategic initiative, but whether they'd want to waste the resources needed to do that is another story, relative to the benefit that they might get out of it. I guess we don't need to worry too much about it. But what the main thing right now would be things like the electronic warfare impact in terms of, like, the hit values, but also the systems that do or don't work. Because on top of the systems that are listed in the rules, shield crackers don't work in there. And most web functions don't work, but you can still use a web fist as a direct fire weapon, albeit it's affected by the same EW penalties as any other direct fire weapon in there.
Right.
But I was also asking on the BBS, because there's a couple of interactions I wasn't too sure about. Because it seems to imply that, for example, if you've got a scout ship or a base, you may or may not be able to use your special sensors to self-jam. So you're not actually projecting the signal to another ship, because you can't do that, the nebula blocks that. But you might be able to make yourself harder to hit. So if you think about it, if that's true, that means that you get the +9 ECM from the nebula itself. And then you get another +6 from your ship's natural. Like, if you set your switches to generate an additional 6 ECM.
Right.
And then, in theory, you can add another 6 ECM from the sensor. So if that's true, then that means that you're going to be difficult to hit. And, but on the other hand, bases are allowed to use their special sensors to generate ECCM. So if you're allowed to generate ECCM as normal, which it seems that you can, then you can basically use all 6 of your ship's sensor switches, whatever, to generate that. So in theory, that's reducing the ECCM that you're firing into from 9 to 3. And if a base is allowed to use its sensors to add another 6 ECCM to itself, then you basically give yourself a bit of a cushion in terms of what kind of electronic warfare shift you're shooting into. So, for example, in theory, like, say, if you're going into a nebula and there's a nebula and say, they put a starbase or a battle station in there, and that base uses its special sensors to, if it's allowed to increase its own ECCM, then any phaser 4s it's got are going to be much easier to hit, even without any new technology rules. It'll be much easier for them to hit you than it would be for you to hit them.
Understood. My one thing that I'm not sure about the special sensors is that when it comes to Nebula, one of the non-functioning systems is considered scout functions. Now, as we pointed out, we don't know what special abilities that the Nebulae have within that can have when it comes to systems or weapons that can operate differently or allow them to have an advantage against the Tholians, which except for the obvious, which is their webs don't work. So
now we do know that also in Captain's Log 41, there is a scenario for the Sartorians and Juggernauts called Fire in the Deep. And in that scenario, there's actually a special rule that allows the Sartorians, because the Sartorians basically, in this scenario, this battle is like the third or fourth battle they've had against Juggernauts, like in intergalactic space, rather. And by that point, they realize that shield crackers are pretty useless against Juggernauts, because only if the Juggernaut points the rotating shield in your direction firing direction, is the shield cracker going to be any use at all? So the special rule permits the Sultorian ships to replace the shield cracker mounts with phaser ones. So in principle, the Tholians might allow the Sultorians to do the same against Nebula, because they know ahead of time that the shield cracker is going to be useless. So if you have the Sultorians refit their ships to add a couple of extra phaser ones, then that's not nothing. I mean, yes, there is still going to be the EW ships, but it's going to be better than the alternative. So at least that's a tiny bit of mitigation there. But I'm trying to remember what the to hit roll is for the Red Fist, like how bad it is, or how good it is in open space relative to what it would be in the Nebula. I mean, those rules are in the Master Rulebook as well that you've got open there, so I guess in theory we could look it up and have a look and see. We should probably also double check the particle cannon to hit rolls, just to see how badly they'd be affected as well. Because bear in mind that the pirate ships themselves, they're allowed access to particle cannons and shield crackers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're probably only going to use the shield cracker in open space to help capture freighters. But for self-defense rolls, this pirate ship, without any Nebulon extra stuff, would in theory have access to particle cannons and phaser ones as well. So those weapons would be affected for them just as much as they would for the guys coming in.
Mm-hmm. That actually brings up a question that just came to mind, which is, for the Nebulon, for inside the Nebula, are the option mounts? Meaning, are the option mounts actually previously weapon locations that were used for Nebulon specific weapons and just removed, and they changed into an actual mount where they could mount whatever weapon that they needed? But I understand.
Well, this is one of the topics that I'm
bringing up, because
maybe they went with a totally modular design. Something not like the other fleets did, because the original like 70s and 80s design concepts that they put out was literally, this is the ship. This is, you know, very little change to it, very little ability to change it, although they did have a special rule for modifying the ships. They didn't have it as doctrine kind of thing, and maybe these guys had it as a doctrine thing, because we're actually moving towards a little bit of that. They're trying to do that in our Navy right now, or they've tried to, and it kind of failed because of like corruption issues, but where they could have replaceable module, so that the ship itself, you could just put it in port, switch out a few modules, and change the mission for the ship. Maybe that's what the option mount design comes from for these guys and the Orions. Just a different mindset of how we're building our ships.
Yeah, but I'm just imagining when it comes to option mounts, is something like the way laptops are made. When it comes to, if you have a built-in weapon system that's not meant to be removed, it's not modular.
Right.
It's going to take up less space and probably more efficient, because it's going to be built, the ship's going to be built for that weapon and the systems that support
the battleship.
Yeah, are going to support that weapon, versus having the generic, and you might actually have some redundant systems or some systems that won't be used while other systems are, they might require, have different requirements when it comes to transfer of power. Like, you know, one might require ion energy, and that has to come directly from like the impulse engines or something along those lines. You know.
Yeah. Well, as the saying goes,
the whole idea of like actual modules is something that's used by the Zosman Marauders in Omega, because their ships are designed that you can literally take the entire module out and replace it with a new one, and the new one could either have different weapons or could have like a support system, that sort of thing. But that's handled a little bit differently. That's probably closer to what you have with the Romulan Firewalks or with the Iridanicus ships. So it's a little bit of a different way of doing a pirate ship compared to what we have here or what the Orions or Jamalkians use.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah, because the Orions and these are, like, at least the old Galaxy Pirates, the ones that lived outside the Nebula, operated outside the Nebula, were designed for a quick switcheroo, so it wouldn't take months, which is what, like, the Romulan modules would take a lot longer to switch out the modules that they had.
So, for what it's worth, my idea would be that the pirate ship, the winged Nebulan ships, like the, I guess, privateers or whatever you want to call them, I would say that those would have option mounts too, because before the ship leaves the Nebula, a specific configuration would be installed, and then that's what it would keep for the remainder of its mission. But I would say that their ships with no wings, the naval ships, I would say that those would have fixed weapons. And that means that you might have a couple of different mission variant SSDs, depending on what weapons you decide to give them. But those would be more like a traditional Navy's fleet in terms of what the SSDs would look like. You wouldn't have the blank optional weapon mounts. You would specifically just put in the weapon charts for the weapons you've given the ship.
Right, which is basically what I just said, which is when it comes to exporting the ships, those had option mounts, but the ships that were actually internal to the Nebula and were actually owned by the Nebulan, those didn't have option mounts. They just had built-in weapon systems that were Nebulan-based.
Yeah, well, that's going to be up to up to the designers.
Oh, agreed.
There's that. And I wouldn't be surprised if they actually leave it with the option mounts for the actual Nebulons themselves, because if you think about it, they're reaching out and they're learning all this new tech. They get the ability to modify at that point, and they're living inside a hostile environment to start with that they're adapting to. So they're probably going to be much more open to being flexible on stuff than, say, the, you know, rigid Tholian Navy setup kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where every ship is going to be, this is the design, these are the weapons, that's it. You know, and that's all you get, Mr. Seltoran, current race in this. So.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
As for, you know, what's their big advantage going to be inside the Nebula? Probably reduced effects.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably just say that the actual non-export ships are specifically adapted to that because of the generations of living in that space that they've had, that they are affected far less by the Nebula than the outside ships coming in.
So,
like,
on the DDS,
like Shindar,
it's
sorry,
what was that, Gary?
So, on the DDS, on the BBS in the discussion thread for the Nebula, I posted a couple of thoughts on this. And so one thing I was thinking of is that when the ships are being built, there'd be some special system that would be woven in as it's being constructed, kind of like the way the stealth field is for Zosmans in Omega. But the system is paid for. So you pay for it like a cloaking device or like a stealth field or something else. I don't know what the cost would be, because I guess that would depend on how good the system is. But the theory would be that when you're not paying for the system, there's no additional benefit. So, but when you are paying for the system, you might get a couple of things. So, for example, one thing I thought is that instead of just having the minimal shields, maybe you get 50% of your full shields, or 60 or 70, whatever percentage is seen as good, good enough, rather. Because mm-hmm. Even if you look at like that FFC, even 50% of a full shield is still really good compared to other empires in the Nebula.
True.
And also, like, maybe you might get some swing EW points that might you could basically either use as ECM or as ECCM on top of the standard ECM, ECCM that your ship has. So maybe one of the advantages they have is that they can use some of those swing points to basically help make it easier for their weapons to hit you or make it more difficult for you to hit them. So maybe one or the other, because it might be a bit too powerful to give them, like, let them use all these, you know, to mix and match. Like, you might have to say to them, you have to use those swing points for ECM or ECCM and for that turn, and that's what you're doing. So, but again, because of the cost, it means that your ship is going to be a little bit slower because you're paying these points. Like, you're paying to run the system on top of everything else that you're doing while you're in there. So that would have a little bit of an impact in terms of the your agility and like your how the pace of the battle that's going on in there. And the other thing too is that there is the whole movement inside, like involuntary movement inside a nebula, if it's a hot nebula rather than a cool nebula. I don't know whether or not they should have the ability maybe to mitigate some of that. I mean, in theory, they could. But, like, for example, in the rules for the nebula right now, I think there's a thing where if you've got a legendary navigator, you can skip one or two of the three involuntary movements. So maybe the system lets them do that too. So they still get affected to a little extent, but they're not as badly affected as standard ships would be. So, do any of those sound like they might be okay? Or if so, what percentage do you think the shields would be good enough to not make them too cheesy?
I think 50% would be good. And what I was thinking about is that with the greater defenses and possibly even built-in stealth, like the Orion pirates, you know, so that their ships could be smaller and go in the nebula itself, be able to fight against heavier ships. And therefore, that would give them a definite advantage in the nebula. And one thing I was thinking before we actually started broadcasting, recording, whatever, was one of the things that I think would be a good advantage because of the and my reasoning behind it is that the nebulae live in the nebula, so they're used to the ebbs and flows of moving in a nebula itself. And one of the rules for Nebula is P6.5. And that is random movement. So every movement during the movement segment of number 5, 15, and 26, all units, including sick and weapons, are moved one hex in a random direction. And that could be either left, right, or actually no change at all. Okay. I think that would be a good advantage to the Nebula, which I don't think would actually, it's an overpowering advantage, an overpowered system, you know, one that actually can basically, in my mind, is that this random movement, they're guessing, they've figured out how the Nebula, you know, ebbs and flows. When it comes to why you get this random movement, so that they can avoid the random movement. They know how to travel through the nebula to avoid that random movement. Whether that's an explicit aspect of the ship, I think obviously it's the easiest way of seeing it versus just the experience of the navigators that fly those ships.
It's probably, it could be a column A, column B thing. You know, their crew is used to this, so they're affected less by the effects of the nebula, and maybe their ships are built, you know, with the ability to ignore some of the effects of the nebula, which is why you have an export model. So,
right.
And well, definitely, here's the thought. Maybe once a turn, they have the ability to decide for themselves which way they move and whether they turn or not.
That is
oh,
true.
Oh, yeah, they could, like, surf the nebula.
Right. And actually, you know, basically use those quote-unquote random movements and say, oh, okay, I'm not, like, those are segments where you get extra moves. You know.
Yeah, that would be actually pretty interesting.
Because you're surfing the wave, dude.
And then the attacking player can say, all surf nebulons must die.
Well, the heavy thing with that idea of a rule is that if you're playing in the quiet nebula, then...
I'm sorry, what was that, Gary?
But if you're playing a quiet nebula, then... Well, I was just thinking that rule, like the surfing the nebula thing, that could only apply if the nebula is active. So if you're playing in a quiet nebula, that's not an advantage. If you don't get to decide suddenly that you want to shift on that impulse, like you just move as normal, even if you're a nebula in ship. So...
Agreed. But the question is there such thing as a quiet nebula? I understand.
Sure, why not? They get a pocket.
Yeah, it says in the rules. It says there that one of the options is that you can play in a quiet nebula, and if you put the quiet nebula is quiet, then there's no random movement.
Yeah, but that's in quote quiet nebula, which that to me gives an impression that it's like playing without EW. You can play without EW, and the thing is, you should be playing with that rule, but in theory, you don't have to. And that's what normally happens with, well, actually, tournament is just limited EW, really limited, but no, it still has some minor EW rules.
Well, think of it like this. I mean, getting people to play test these ships might be a challenge in the first place because you don't want it to be too complicated. So maybe the first couple of play tests could be in a quiet nebula just to make sure that the other proposed systems work. And then once people are confident playing in the quiet nebula, they can start playing in a more active, volatile nebula and then let them try these other rules and see if they work out or not. And if they don't work, then they can be adjusted or removed or whatever. But yeah, right. It would basically be part of a step-by-step process to make sure that everything functions the way it would hopefully would.
Understood. Now, the question we have not hit upon yet, which is, what kind of weapons would they have? Meaning, would they focus on direct fire weapons? But then you have the problem with the built-in ECM.
I've got a couple of ideas for that as well.
Go ahead.
So just remember, one of the things I was thinking about that combat system is that it might give you some swing EW points. So if you're using the ECCM version of it, and hopefully that might make it easier for your weapons to hit the other guy. But since nebulae are basically giant clumps of plasma, I think it would make sense for the weapons to be plasma direct fire weapons, because seeking weapons don't really work against, again, that galaxy in general. And but on the other hand, there are a couple of interesting weapons that are in the, they're actually in the Electronic Master Rulebook as well. But they're up to this point, there's not a lot of use for them historically. So I, for what it's worth, think that maybe a couple of them could be borrowed for use here. And one of them is, if you go to, I think it's FP12.0 or FP14.0, and have a look for the plasma carronade.
Hmm. Yeah, I know the Carony. There's Sebo, Plasma Rax. Actually, it's, you said it's 12, right?
I think it's like 12 or 14, one of those two.
12 is ECM, 13 is Type K. Carony, there it is, 14.
Okay. Now, historically, the plasma carronade was invented by the Gorns to be an additional direct fire option for the plasma F-torpedo. But if you look in the rules, like in the first couple of paragraphs, it actually says that it's engineering-wise, it's possible to invent a weapon that is only this. As in, like, it fires with a carronade, but it doesn't fire plasma bolts, and it doesn't fire torpedoes. And if you do, you mark it on the SSD as PVL, and then the rules that you see below, you would follow those rules to operate this weapon.
Hmm, there it is, yeah. Oh, PLC. There it is.
Now, oh, sorry, PVL is the other weapon I'm going to mention. That's, I think I just got ahead of myself there. So
yeah.
Keep the PVL thing in your head for a moment. Put it to the side for a moment. We'll get back to it later. But yes, PLC is the one that we're talking about, plasma carronade.
Right.
And,
I was just seeing it. In the third case of a carronade only weapon PLC, it would be destroyed as a plasma F. Yeah.
Now, the handy thing about the plasma carronade is that it's a range of effect weapon, so the true range is always the same as the effective range. And its firing chart is actually kind of similar to a phaser's. But when you arm it the same way as a standard plasma X. So the amount of damage that you see on the firing chart, that is basically if you fire it every turn with 1 point of power. But if you load it over two turns, like you know how a plasma F, you load it 1+1+3. So right. You can load a carronade 1+1+3, but you can actually fire it with 1, 2, or 3 turns of turns of power. And when you do that, you add +1 to the amount of damage you do for every additional point of power you add into it. So if you want to fire it over three turns, then you get the most reinforced hit. But you don't have to, because the weapon's flexible enough where you can decide for yourself how often you want to fire it. However, it is a very short-range weapon, so
yeah,
you have to get really close and personal to use it.
Okay. Yeah, what you explain? Oops. And that is, there's no true.
And the handy thing too is that.
Mm-hmm.
The handy thing too is that when that weapon is used in open space, at least, it can be used to sweep mines. So in theory, if say for example, if you've got enough SSDs free to build a campaign-compatible Nebulon fleet so that you can represent the fleet they used to fight the Great Martial War, then, in principle, you could build them a minesweeper variant of one of their ships, one or more of their ships. Because mines do exist in the home galaxy, and minesweepers too. So you could give them a minesweeper variant and then give that variant a bunch of carronades so they can use them to basically try to sweep the mines along with its wages.
You still there, Paul?
Yeah, I'm just reading in the designer notes on the plasma carronade. That's all.
Okay.
Eh. Okay. Yeah, as Gary was mentioning, yeah, that you can actually have more than one point of power in the plasma carronade, the PLC. If it's a carronade only weapon. Problem is, of course, the true range is only, maximum range is 5 hexes, which is very close. But it will do 4 points of damage maximum with a minimum of 2, looks like. But with each and every point, additional point, it produces one more additional point of damage. So a maximum is 6 points of damage with a minimum of 4. Which is kind of neat. Now, what was the PVL?
Okay, so the PVL is, right now it's only an early years weapon, but I guess I was proposing that maybe a modern version of it could be created. So if you scroll near to the very end of the Master Rulebook, you'll see the Y era section rules, like the earlier stuff.
Yep.
And in there, you'll see a number of direct fire heavy weapons. And one of those was, it's basically because, I don't know if you recall when Module Y2 was first published, they used that module to basically create the 5 planetary fleets for the pre-interstellar Concordium. So the 5 species that are created the ISC, that module shows you what their ships look like when they were still building them separately. And unlike in the Federation, the 5 pre-ISC planets each built their own separate type of plasma weapon. So one species built a primitive torpedo, one gun built a primitive plasma drone, and the other 3 built various types of direct fire weapons. And one of those direct fire weapons is a thing called the Plasma Vortex Launcher, or PVL.
Got the plasma blaster, the plasma cannon. Ah, there's vortex launcher. Okay.
So that weapon is also a weapon that you can arm over 1, 2, or 3 turns. And if you go through the rules, you should be able to see the hit charts and the damage charts and so forth for each arming level. The catch is that the early years version of the weapon cannot be held, and it can't use rolling delay either. So you have to fire it on the first, second, or third turn at that turn's arming level, or you lose the weapon. So it's relatively limited in that sense, at least in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
And one other thing too is this is a big weapon, so it actually takes up 2 central line adjacent option mounts, the equivalent space. So say for example, if you look at the Pirate Raider and it's got 5 option mounts, the front 4, you could use the 2 of them to install 2 of these weapons, but the 5th option mount will have to be some other weapon.
But what's the range?
I think if you check the damage charts, each of the firing modes,
I
think the maximum range is about 15 hexes or so, something like that.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing as well, the other thing is that in the early years, there's no accelerated arming option. So you have to wait the 3 turns to arm to the 3rd army level.
Right.
So, before we go any further, we should probably just have a quick review of the weapon as it is, just to see what it can or can't do, and then I've got a couple of ideas of how a modern version could work, but before we get to that, I wanted to get everyone's sense of what they think of the weapon so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, don't mind me, I'm just getting to that point. Okay, arming, energy, as you pointed out, 2 points of energy for each of either 1, 2, or 3 consecutive turns. The launcher can be armed with 2 points of energy and fired every turn, right? If the plasma vortex launcher is armed and not fired or discharged on the previous turn, 2 more points of energy can be allocated to the following turn. And you know, the energy allocation, right? Then it's discussing that, okay, you know, if you previously charged it for the previous 2 turns, you can charge it for a 3rd turn. Right, lost energy is discharged. The weapon can be fired only once per turn at its lowest level, or once every other turn at its intermediate level, or once every 3rd turn in maximum arming level. So depending upon how much you charged it, it will require the same amount of returns that it took to charge it to that level to actually be able to fire it again. Interesting. Because that makes it basically multi-turn army weapons, which you can define how quickly you actually can fire the weapon. But the, you know, it's kind of interesting. Annoying that you can't do a rolling delay. The plasma vortex launcher begins arming in a turn. And it's not fired, it must continue arming with allocated bomb. If in the weapon or the energy in the weapon is discharged. If the weapon does not have enough energy in it to complete the 1st turn arming, by the end of the turn, the energy in the weapon is discharged. Okay. So it seems like that you actually do have an option, which is if you don't want to have it so that you charge it possibly up to 3 turns, you can have it so it is a single turn arm weapon. You just have to discharge it at the end of the turn if you don't actually want to keep charging it for the 2nd turn arming. Feedback damage to the plasma vortex launcher arm with 6 points, a true range of 0, the fire unit receives 6 points of feedback damage. And it doesn't say anything about any at the lower levels. So I'm assuming there's no feedback damage if the number of points, energy points in the weapon is less than 6.
Well, do you have the damage chart up as well?
Mm-hmm. It's
so you can see that the weapon can be it can be quite powerful actually if you get all 3 turns into it, but it's still very much a use it or lose it situation at each level for now anyway.
Right, exactly, because in the case of if you get a charge for the 3rd turn you have and you don't fire it, the only option is to discharge the weapon. Because if you don't have any rolling delay, and you don't have an ability to hold the weapon, at least at the moment, the way it is for the early years.
So what I was thinking was to give it maybe one or both of the following. One would be the ability to do either a hold or rolling delay at each army level. So if it's a rolling delay, you're paying the same for 2 points. So it's kind of like, you know, in the Magellanic Cloud, the charged particle accelerator. So those weapons, you're paying 3 points of power every turn, no matter whether you're keeping it at the same army level or if you're raising the army level. So I would basically have the same dynamic here, where at the end of the turn, you're paying 2 points either to keep it on the rolling delay or to, at the beginning of the next turn, you're basically paying the 2 points to raise it to the next army level. And then the other thing I was thinking was to maybe give it like a accelerated arming option where, say, for example, if you're on turn one and you've only got a level one arming, you could use reserve power to top it up to level two, but not to level three right away. Like, I wouldn't say that you could top up both levels immediately. It, at the moment of firing. So say if you've got the reserve power spare and the opportunity arrives, then you could use that reserve power to do a kind of pseudo overload. So you can go from one to two or from two to three, but not from one to three, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Because, let me bring it up again, sorry. Which is the damage allocation chart, you know, the weapon table. And it's definitely a close-in weapon. You know, outside of range three, you know, the amount of damage is not that great. For example, 4 to 8 with 6 points of energy that you put in this thing, you can either have 6 points of damage, 3 points of damage, or 2 points of damage. So you put 6 points of energy for 3 points of damage. Not really efficient. And yes, it can fire all the way out. It can out to range 15, but with 6 points of energy, it's 3, 2, 1. So we're taking on the stand to for a certain degree, but again, it makes it a very short range weapon. And it is, maybe that's just the way we want the Nebulon. You know, the Nebulon is has better protection, has only these close-in weapons, which basically you wouldn't want to use outside the nebula, because of the only thing that's saving your butt inside the nebula is the additional shielding and also the amount of ECM. And possibly, we have, I know I mentioned this, which was additional ECM provided by the ship itself. You know, a special coating, something along the stealth ability of the Orion ships, where they have additional ECM just because of the way the ship was designed. Well, not quite, because the Orion ships that are made for the winds don't have that the stealth mode, you know, that kind of thing. So it doesn't have the additional ECM abilities.
Don't they? I'm pretty sure that the Wind Orion ships do have the stealth coating as standard, but they don't have the engine doubling.
Right. Oh, that's one thing. You might be right there. I'd have to double check on that.
Both be.
It actually sounds.
But in contrast, neither the Jamaican Pirates or the Zosmans have any natural ECM. They have to use their paid-for systems to generate any kind of benefit. Kind of like running into the cloak.
But that brings the question
it, well,
of.
If you're in a nebula. Because, like, if you're fighting in a nebula, because of the EW penalty, a lot of ships are going to be shooting each other at very short range anyway. And if that's going to be happening, then this weapon, the plasma vortex launcher, it would be proportionally more effective for them, especially if they're able to choose how many turns they want to arm it before they swoop in and take their shot with.
Understood. But the question is that kind of ships that we want the Nebulon to be? Because I agree that just because of the ECM that's built into the nebula itself, you know, the 9 points of ECM, that you're going to be most probably fighting at a very close range. But in the case of the Nebulon, do you actually want to force them to be close in? I would think that what you'd want is a weapon which could fire at a longer distance, which is not as easily affected by ECM, so that you have that advantage within the nebula itself.
Well, the carronade is generally pretty resistant to EW as is, so I think that would be, even without any kind of bonus system, that would be a useful weapon for them up close as well. This weapon might be more for, for example, like say if the Tholians or the Sultorians are sending in dreadnoughts, or even if maybe they might even send in the battle wagon. Those things are hard to kill, even though the shields are weak, relatively weak into the nebula. So having a more powerful weapon that they can turn to try to deal with those larger enemies might be useful. But it would still take a while for them to chip away at those kind of large units in comparison to what the Tholians or the Sulphorians would be doing. But, like, to give you an example, if you look at the SSD, now, if you imagine, like, a wingless version would probably have to move some of the boxes around, like, get rid of the cargo boxes and try to find more kind of standard positions for things, like, actually, maybe, because they'd only be able to use the tractor beams outside the nebula, because they're useless inside the nebula.
Right.
And same with the transporters. So, but, say, for example, like, if there's, like, because it looks like the Raider that you see the SSD for, it seems to be based on a light cruiser. So, say if you have the standard wingless version of the light cruiser, has only two warp boxes, two warp engines, like 10 points each. And it has the same amount of space that is used up by the option mounts here on the front, but it doesn't have the one on the side, like the wing option mount is gone. Then, in theory, you could have like a phaser version that has four phaser ones, additional phaser ones, I should say. Or you could have a carronade version that has four plasma carronades. That could be the minesweeper version too, because as you were saying, the carronades are pretty good for that. And there could be a plasma vortex variant where the four option mounts are space is taken up by two plasma vortex launchers. So those weapon variants basically give you a bit of a variety in terms of how you're planning to engage the enemy as they're coming into the nebula.
Yeah, well, that is, I guess, that's what really defines what the Nebulon is going to be, which is what kind of tactics will they be employing against any intruders? Because it's like the wind cluster. The wind cluster, the way it's designed is that the ships within the cluster itself are designed a certain way. They're you know, these large freighters, small freighters, you know, they say auxiliary cruisers. But they have all these weapons. Now, normally, you couldn't really have this operating in open space. But because of the way the wing clustered, you have to go through that a thick layer of just nastiness to get in fully into the wind cluster where you can actually live and survive. The ships that are designed to operate within the wind cluster really couldn't operate outside the wind cluster because they get the crap beat out of them. But and the question is, would the Nebulon be the same way? I understand that the wind cluster and the nebula are two different things when it comes to the different penalties and what actually happens. Because with like the wind, you have it so that they're not able to fire for a certain number of turns. Well, this is different in the nebula. In nebula, you don't have that same issue. Yes, you have the issue with the ECM. Yes, you have the issue with the possibility of random movement. Yes, you have the disabling of multiple functions, multiple systems. For example, the tractor beams no longer work. Small units like fighters and shuttles, they automatically get destroyed. They're dead. There's no use. You can't use wild weasels, which is another advantage that would be great to take. Well, one thing that you could take advantage of while you're in the nebula. I mean, the Nebulon could use, which is using seeking weapons within the nebula against them, because you can't use wild weasels. So you, in theory, should be able to overwhelm the target, because they can no longer, if they get overwhelmed, they can no longer stop, do an ED and maneuver, and then launch the wild weasels. You can't do that anymore. And you know, the Tholians don't have anything like the SWAC, like the Federation have, which, you know, can attract seeking weapons to itself. But of course, that's a very expensive way of using a SWAC. You use that well, come on.
If it saves your carrier, it saves your carrier, though.
Agreed. And normally, when you use SWACs, you use a pair of SWACs. One on one side, one on the other side. And the idea is that you just turn on the attraction for one. And then when it gets close to that one, you turn it off and you attract it the other way. And so it goes flying back to the other SWAT. You know? Which is very effective. Because while it's going back and forth, it's not actually targeted on the ships. It's actually the ships are just targeting it, and will destroy all the drones or other sneaking weapons. What was it, Gary?
Just bear in mind that wild weasels don't exist in the home galaxy, even in open space. And also, the sneaking weapons do take damage through movement within the nebula. So they're not as effective as they are in open space either. But I think, I guess the final point now, because I guess we're running low on time again, is in Omega, there's an empire called the Kixa, and their home territory, the Kixavalo Cloud, it has pockets of open space, mainly around planets. So some of the battles that take place inside the cloud take place in those pockets. But the cloud itself is a volatile gas, so the rules are different than a nebula. But Kixa ships are more expensive DPV-wise when they fight inside the cloud, because everyone else, just by moving through the cloud, your ship takes damage. And you've got damage that you take or you cause to the other guy based on the weapons that you fire. So, for example, if you drop a mine, a T-bomb, if you plant a T-bomb in the Kixavalo cloud, the explosion of the T-bomb is actually magnified by the gases in the cloud. But Kixa ships are actually designed so that their warp fields don't trigger a reaction. So they actually take no damage inside the cloud. and they tailor their weapons so that they trigger effects that only happen in the tribe. It also means that the variant weapons that they have in open space are relatively basic. They're not that great. So the BPV is actually much lower for their fighting in open space. And so they would be the closest equivalent to the Nebuline here in the sense that they're able to fight in the actual terrain that defines them, as opposed to the terrain being a border between an open space area on the outside and an open space bubble on the inside. So by that logic, I would suggest that any SSDs for the Nebuline ships should also have two BPVs. So one BPV is for open space combat, and another BPV would be for fighting inside the Nebula.
Oh, agreed. That makes sense. It's like scouts. The scouts have basically EPV and a BPV, and the EPV is used for the point value for basically used as the BPV in the case of fleet battles. But if it's in a dual scenario, one on one, then you use the actual BPV, which is it's a jury rig. That's one way of making it so that even though it's possible that the actual BPV for a scout is not equivalent to the EPV, you can use that as a placeholder for and when it comes to the case of a scout.
So that in and of itself would be a useful balancing factor, because if you're sending Thorian or Sultorian ships into the Nebula, their PPV is not adjusted. But the Nebulan ships that are defending against them are going to be proportionally more expensive. So you've got that dynamic where you can tailor that kind of balance level to make sure that it works in game terms and also historically.
I guess it all comes down to how nasty do they make them inside the worm, inside their...
inside the nebula, yeah.
Base. And it's all and how, speculation.
Until right, you and how different is the ship when it comes to the way it looks inside the nebula and the ones that are actually exported outside the nebula? Is it just that big wing is removed, or is there any other modifications that occur to make it quote unquote exportable, other than the obvious, which is the Nebuline specific systems and Nebuline specific weapons?
I would say it's probably going to be something like specific.
Well, I mean, in theory, what you could do is like you see how the SSD here has 10 box engines, so it's more like a middle years light cruiser in alpha terms. So maybe they did eventually build a war cruiser that has 12 box engines, but because it's a wartime construction ship, they can't put the wing on it. So they only use the war cruiser for their Navy ship, either in open space before the Martial War or for home defense after. But for engineering purposes, they have to use their equivalent of a middle year ship to put the wing on and have it actually be stable enough to capture a freighter. So that could also be an interesting way to make a distinction between the two fleets, in that the without the wing, the ships in the Nebula are more powerful, but that extra power works against it in terms of being able to modify it for going outside to capture things.
Understood. Okay, well, it's getting late. I think we should need to wrap it up here. It's been a wonderful discussion about the Nebuline and some of the possibilities of weapon, at least the weapon systems, possibly system within the ships themselves. Gary, it's always nice to have you around. You have a good night.
Thank you. Have a good night. And once again, if anyone has any thoughts about the Nebuline, what they've heard here, or something new they want to add, go right over to the BBS and check out the thread and post your thoughts there.
Okay. Cool. Doug, always a pleasure having you to talk with on a Thursday night. You have a good night.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on. Gamers of Summer's coming up. Anybody listening want to come out and play Monsters? Or play against Monsters, or play Monsters, because some of the scenarios involve players playing Monsters as well as playing against Monsters. But that's what Paul has listed for Gamers of Summer as an ongoing thing through the weekend, and along with his demos. Just wondering, and it's just a random thought, but what about for Gamers of Winter, maybe throwing out, and just think about this, maybe we'll talk about it next time or down the road a bit, throwing out like mini campaigns like the Lone Gray Wolf or something like that, so have that scenario as a multi-D deal where on day one you play one side, you play both sides with multiple players playing different aspects of that over a 2-day period.
You know what? Well, I actually need, I think it'd be the best. I need to make arrangements with one other player, so them and me will play there, at least for the first 2 days of the convention. Whether it is, one of the mini campaigns, or something smaller, something that can be close to be completed in 2 days' time. Definitely not an F&E game.
Oh, heck no. But there are some small scenario, small mini campaigns. Like I said, Lone Gray Wolf came to mind off the top, because that one's literally just a few scenarios that how you do in one affects the next. So there's that. If you want to maybe post something on there about SFB on the thread for gamers, that would be awesome too. Because there was somebody who asked, is there going to be any SFB there? And it's like, I just listed the thing. I just pasted the update that lists the SFB events. And the guy's asking, is there going to be any SFB events there? I'm like, it's right there. The Monsters.
So. Understood. He posted it on Facebook.
Yeah. Okay. Go on and look sometime.
Okay, I'll see if I can find him and maybe make arrangements to play a mini campaign against him this upcoming convention.
Not necessarily the mini campaign this upcoming event, but maybe as the thing for the winter event.
Right.
Where we're more likely to get more people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but maybe talk to him about, I'm running the Monsters thing if you want to come out, because the thing is, there's so many things you can do with SFB. It's like, what is going to get some people to come out and actually do something at this event that they don't normally do?
Understood.
So, other than that, if you want to come up sometime and work on computer stuff as far as like setting up the things you were talking about, setting up to see how they work, and being able to see it on like my machines for what you're doing, that's fine. I will be here.
Also, yeah, it's going to be a bit of time just because I'm going to be busy for the next month.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
All right, and that's all I had, pretty much. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. So, had a nice discussion about the Nebuline and so many ideas. Hopefully, well, they're waiting to see what the Nebuline actually become to be. Lord knows, I'm one of those people, I'm really interested into the history of the Tholian galaxy. Also, you know, the reign of the Tholian will, the different races, especially the ones that actually survive the Tholian will, even if there's something along the lines of the LMC, where some of them were completely obliterated by the Andromedans, other ones were just a little shell of what they were, you know, when the Andromedans showed up in the galaxy. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.